From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, Wisconsin's 10-year employment picture. Later, writer Larry Tye shares a rule of thumb which he contends applies to the Man of Steel.
Anytime a name ends in the word M-A-N, it's one of two things. It is either a superhero or a Jew, or in this case, it's both.
A Milwaukee rep production tells the story of Superman's creator, and a local group floats a new plan for a basketball arena.
We thought, with the establishment of the World Water Hub and the jewel that is Lake Michigan, that an offshore floating arena would be a mecca for basketball fans and freshwater researchers alike. We could even rename our franchise the Milwaukee Bubblers.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. The news came last week that Wisconsin's unemployment rate dipped 0.1 of a percentage point to 6.1% in February. At the same time, the initial job numbers also showed a net loss of more than 1,000 jobs during the month as well. But UW-Milwaukee researcher Mark Levine says a decade-long analysis of the state's jobs picture provides a more complete look at the state of employment here. Levine is senior fellow and founding director of the Center for Economic Development at UWM. He joins us in the studio to explain more. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mitch. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start with the data itself. What is the overall picture of employment growth in Wisconsin since 2002?
Well, since 2002, I think it's fair to say employment growth has been quite anemic in Wisconsin. Over the last decade, we've basically not moved the needle at all in terms of job creation. We've got roughly in the neighborhood of 2.7 million jobs in 2002, and we've got roughly 2.7 million jobs today. We've been through some ups and downs as a consequence, obviously, of the huge loss that occurred around the Great Recession between 2007 and 2009. But basically, we've got a fairly stagnant job creation climate in the state.
Well, and so for people who are wondering, where does the data come from that you synthesize?
This is the best federal data that we've got. This is from the quarterly census of employment and wages, which is a census. It's not just a sample survey of 3 or 4% of employers, which is done monthly. The QCEW, as it's called, this quarterly census, is done every 3 months, and it's a census of about 98% of all the businesses in the country. So it's a count, really, of the jobs that are created, as well as the wages in them and the like. So it's really from the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington, and it's the best data that we've got.
Why did you choose 2002? Simply because a decade is kind of a magic number?
Well, partially that, and also partially that's where the best QCEW data starts. You can go back historically. It gets a little less secure. So to use the absolute best data, we started then. And 2002 is also kind of convenient because it's right after the end of the previous recession. There was a 2001-2002 recession, so we start essentially at the trough and work our way up, which is the way that economists look at business cycles.
Well, so what are the most important patterns that you see that emerge in looking at how Wisconsin's growth rate has lagged?
Well, the most important and interesting, I think, finding that we had was that there really are kind of three trends that occur over the decade period, and in some ways, where we're at today in terms of the quite anemic job growth that we're facing in 2013, 2014, is as a consequence of the confluence of these three trends. The overriding one is that we've clearly been in a period of what we would call secular or long-term stagnation and even decline. Again, this is not particularly news to folks who have monitored the Wisconsin economy, but being a heavily manufacturing-based economy, the most heavily manufacturing-based in the country, it'll vary in years between us and Indiana, but basically we're the two. In 2001, about 22% of the labor force in Wisconsin was employed in manufacturing. Today, it's a little over 14%. So we've had a drop in manufacturing employment. There's been a decline in manufacturing nationally. We call this deindustrialization. Rob Atkinson, a Washington policy wonk, referred to the manufacturing performance in the country in the last decade as the worst since the Great Depression, and in some ways worse than the Great Depression.
Granted, manufacturing has been in decline. It's been in decline around the country, but you cite research that shows Milwaukee in particular was vulnerable to competition from Chinese imports.
Well, that's right. I mean, we get hit especially hard in manufacturing by the decline in manufacturing for two reasons. One, we have a disproportionate share of our workforce in manufacturing. So as manufacturing declines, a state that has a disproportionate share of their workforce in manufacturing is going to experience a greater decline than other states. So that's the first factor. And the other factor, as you alluded to, is that we've been particularly buffeted by the ill winds of trade, for want of a better phrase. We've lost jobs to Mexico and to China over the last decade. Research from MIT economist David Autour and his colleagues suggest that about 55% of the manufacturing job loss in the country over the last decade has been as a consequence of the China trade, low-wage competition and the like, and that Milwaukee, of the 40 metropolitan areas that they looked at, ranked eighth in vulnerability to the China trade. And we've obviously seen that. Heavy manufacturing, durable goods manufacturing can be undercut by cheaper Chinese labor. But we shouldn't also forget the Mexico factor and that NAFTA has cost us a fair number, again, of manufacturing jobs, estimates somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20,000 jobs there. So you combine China and Mexico and you're talking about, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70,000 jobs that have been lost over the decade.
Well, and so I interrupted you. You were talking about a confluence of three different factors and manufacturing and its decline was one of them. What are the other two?
Well, then the other two factors are, I think, the policy mix that's occurred in the state over the last decade. Even though we had this long-term stagnation, even though we were devastated, as were states across the country, by the Great Recession, a really curious thing just pops out in the data, and that is as Wisconsin is ranking fairly poorly in job creation through the 2000s, through the decade, ranking between somewhere between 30 and 45th, 46th among the states, in 2010, we shoot up to 13th. We're in the top, almost the top 10 of states, and we stay sort of close to that. I think we're in the 20s in 2011 before again dropping back in the last couple of years. And what we found, which hasn't really been analyzed in any great detail, so this is kind of an original contribution of this paper, is that Wisconsin experienced a huge infusion, a huge injection of federal funds in the 2009-2010 period. We were a beneficiary of the stimulus program of the Obama administration, the much debated, often criticized, but ultimately fairly successful infusion of $800 billion nationally into the economy. Well, Wisconsin, between 2009 and 2010, we had always bumped along about 47th or 48th in the country in the amount of federal funding that we received among the states. We jumped all the way up to 21st, an unprecedented jump. In the dollar amount, in the percentage increase, we were second in the country in the amount of stimulus dollars that we got. Only Hawaii was higher, and I don't want to relate that to President Obama's home state, but they got a 63% increase. Ours was 53%, and in the actual dollar amount, here's the amazing thing: we were fourth behind California, Florida, and Virginia with about a $21 billion increase. And to put that in perspective, that 21% roughly equals about 10% of Wisconsin's GDP. So we got this huge $21 billion. Infusion of funds to keep teachers at work, to give urban governments money to keep delivering services. Lots of Wisconsin businesses got procurement contracts through the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense. Long list of Wisconsin companies got funds. And so the bottom line was we had this infusion of funds which counteracted to some extent the recession, but also to some extent began to counteract the long-term stagnation and push Wisconsin from being at the bottom of the employment growth more to the top.
Well, what explains that? Is this the effectiveness of Wisconsin politicians on a national level?
Well, I think to some extent in this case it probably was. David Obey, former congressman from Wisconsin, was very powerful. was the head of the House Appropriations Committee, which structured the stimulus bill, which structured federal spending generally. And I think Wisconsin was well positioned at that point. And it kind of begs the question, why have we not been well positioned before to get these federal funds? And I think, you know, it's a different conversation perhaps to have, you know, the general lack of defense contracting available in Wisconsin, even though we did get a fair amount of it in the stimulus package, maybe the failure to lobby in the past. I mean, I'm not sure of all the reasons, but clearly we benefited a lot. I might even hypothesize we benefited from the fact of being a swing state and the desire to stabilize or consolidate, you know, any gains that have been achieved there. I mean, again, I don't know exactly the reasons, but I do know from an economics perspective that there was this infusion of funds, and we see really no other plausible explanation for why Wisconsin's job performance rose compared to other states so profoundly during this period except for this massive infusion of funds. And then the third point is obviously the more recent anemic growth phase, really the last 3 years, and that corresponds to a sharp right turn in policy both at the federal level and at the state level, and that is a turn towards austerity. Whereas the 2009-2010 period marked a classic Keynesian infusion of funds, public investment, priming the pump, and ultimately stabilizing the economy, after 2010, particularly after the midterm elections and the budgetary stalemate that occurred after that, we entered nationally into what we all know as sequestration, which meant obviously budget freezes and budget cuts in many areas in non-entitlement spending, budget cuts of around 7 to 10%. So we had that federal austerity, and of course we had the turn toward austerity at the state level with the Walker administration. We saw obviously Act 10, which took dollars out of the pockets of public employees. We saw the budget cuts in schools, which ranked Wisconsin 7th in the country in terms of the amplitude of those cuts, about a 10% cut between fiscal year 2011 and 2012. We saw a $250 million cut in expenditures for higher education, and then assorted other cuts in terms of aid for local governments. You put all those together, and it's over $1 billion of budget cuts sucked out of the economy. In certain ways, the direct opposite of what happened with the stimulus.
Well, but connect the dots for us. How does taking that money out of the state budget connect to a reduction in job creation?
Well, when you take that money out of the budget, you reduce aggregate demand. There's not as much money injected into the economy. You're taking money out of people's pockets. You're taking money potentially out of the customer base, you know, for businesses. And so it has the reverse effect of injecting dollars into the economy. Now, these things in some ways work at the margins. There are other national factors operating. But here's, again, the very disturbing part for Wisconsin, and that is we have over the last 3 years consistently lagged the national growth rate. So the state economy in some ways obviously is a product of what's going on nationally. And so we can surf, if you will, a little bit on those national increases, but we're not. We're lagging. In the last year that we analyzed the data for, this September 2012 to 2013, our growth rate was only 66%, or in other words, about two-thirds of the national rate. Year before that, it was only, I think, 90%. The year before that, again, about 70%. We're lagging behind the national growth rate. We're lagging behind the Minnesota growth rate, kind of a benchmark state. And so that obviously says that some of the things that we're doing at the state level to pull dollars back out of circulation, if you will, retrenchment, is simply not producing the overall growth that was expected. Now, the theory behind all right. this is that if you have an austerity budget, if you have a tight budget, if you cut public spending, it will create a business climate that will encourage business to invest. Businesses investing will ultimately hire people. Hiring people will put money in people's pockets, and there will be a virtuous circle of economic growth being created.
So is there anything in your analysis that would indicate that couldn't happen?
There's nothing that would indicate it couldn't happen. There's nothing to indicate that it's happening, which is, I think, the more important point. And we've now had a good 2.5 years of data since basically the budgetary policies in Wisconsin have been put in place to create this effect. Now, all sorts of excuses have been made, that business confidence was placed on hold because of quote unquote uncertainty about the recall. That, of course, is a transparently fallacious argument because by that token, there's always uncertainty because there's always an election coming up. I mean, the notion that there might have been an election at a shorter time frame creating this greater uncertainty, I mean, there's just no evidence to support that. And the evidence that actually further contradicts it is that job growth has actually been slower since the recall than it was before the recall. So if the recall created this certainty, that certainty hasn't generated growth. The other argument that's often made is that austerity policies and a tight budgetary ship and, again, cutting back on public expenditures while, for example, giving tax cuts to the affluent and to business is supposed to create, I guess, what Paul Krugman has called the confidence fairy, that it will create confidence on the part of business that the state is being run on a business-like basis and this will lead to economic growth. Again, all we can do is look at the evidence, and the job creation rate since the budgetary policies that led to austerity or the budgetary policies that represented austerity came into place in June of 2011, job creation has been slower since then than actually it was before because prior to June 2011, we were still kind of reaping the benefits of that surge in stimulus spending. So there really is no evidence to suggest that things are getting substantially better as a consequence of state policies and that to the extent that we have been creating jobs in the last couple of years, it's basically been because we've been participating but at a much lower level than we should have in the national recovery. There's no sort of extra Wisconsin bounce that's going on.
Well, Mark Levine, thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Mitch.
Mark Levine is Senior Fellow and Founding Director of the Center for Economic Development at UW-Milwaukee. He's one of the authors of the recent study, Gauging Employment Growth in Wisconsin, State-by-State Comparisons, September 2002 to 2013. A short break now, and when we return, is Superman Jewish? How about Christian? Maybe Buddhist? The confluence of the classic superhero story and faith traditions, and some more you didn't know about the Man of Steel when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Of all the superheroes that have found their way off the pages of the comics and into other media, the one that spans the most generations is Superman. The Man of Steel has been on the scene for more than three quarters of a century, from comic books to the funny pages, from the George Reeves TV version to The Adventures of Lois and Clark, and from the Christopher Reeve movie Superman to Brandon Routh's portrayal. But for as long as you've known about Superman, how much do you know about how he came to be? Thanks to Larry Tye's recent book, we know a lot more. Tye is author of Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, which covers nearly every aspect of the long history of the man with a big S on his chest. Larry Tye, welcome to Lake Effect.
Great to be with you here.
One of the things that strikes me from the early history you describe in this book is that there was never really a plan for how Superman would develop. It is difficult to imagine any franchise like this developing in this way today.
So basically the plan was to get it into print any way they could, and they had tried every publisher of every kind of comic books and comic strips and everything back then, and they ended up in 1938, selling the rights to Superman in perpetuity in every medium out there for a combined total to be divided between the two creators of $130.
This was not an especially savvy financial deal.
It was the steel. If Manhattan looked like a steel, Superman was an even better bargain.
In fairness, though, how secure was the future for comic books as a medium at that point?
There really was no future for comic books. What comic books were back then was mainly a reprint of the comic strips, and it was very little original copy. And a guy got an idea to start this comic book called Action Comics and was looking for something to help drive Action Comics sales and thought this idea of a Superman was a bit weird and tried it on one or two covers in the first five or six issues and discovered that hundreds of thousands of copies flew off the shelves every time Superman was on the cover. And it didn't take a genius to decide he ought to be on the cover every time.
Well, and what's stunning about that is that really Superman was exactly not the only feature in this comic collection, if you will.
He might not have even been the best feature in that comic collection, but he was the one who stuck around. Kids loved him. And 75 years later, we're here at an eminent radio station talking about Superman.
Well, give us a little insight into the creators of Superman. They came from sort of divergent backgrounds, but there were a couple of things that they both had in common that really led them to kind of dream up this guy.
So we never had much idea what they really had in mind until in the course of researching this book, I came across a 150-page unpublished memoir by the writer of Superman, the original creator, Jerry Siegel. And he described a story that I think gave a sense of just what it was about Superman that so caught on with the imagination of all of his fellow kids across America and across the world. And that was every day when Jerry Siegel, who grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, in a section called Glenville that was 80% Jewish, every day when he would go out to the playground, Jerry was a little bit too short and he was a little bit too round and he wore glasses that looked more like Coke bottles than glasses. And all the other boys would point at him and yell, "Siegel, Siegel, birds of an eagle." Now, I have no idea what that means, but I know that you don't want kids pointing at you and saying that, and you don't want the girls watching them do it. And Jerry Siegel basically told us that he invented this extraordinary character, Superman, to help him, in his imagination, fight back against the bullies on the playground. And I don't know about you, but I think that I have within me somewhere buried both the kid who is afraid of the bullies and the kid who wants the girls to think if they look deep enough into my soul, they would see a Superman.
Well, and try growing up with the last name of Tyke. The book, you mentioned that he grew up in this Jewish part of Cleveland. And the book has been out in paperback for some time, but you've been on an interesting kind of extended tour. You have been speaking at a lot of synagogues and Jewish community centers because one of the interesting angles your book takes is on the faith background that undergirds the Superman story, and that is both in the faith of Superman's creators and the kind of universe they were in and that of Superman himself.
Sure. So the truth is that over the last 75 years, every religion on the planet has embraced Superman as theirs. The story that they teach in Sunday schools, in Christian and Catholic churches all across the world, is the story they tell. They talk about a godlike figure in a faraway planet sending his firstborn and only son down to Earth to show mankind that it could be better than it thought it could be. And to them, Superman is the perfect metaphor for the Christ story. Buddhists say, wait a minute, Superman is the ultimate Zen-like character. Nobody more knows instinctively what's going on in the world than him. Atheists and agnostics say, but Superman is the secular Messiah. Who needs God or who needs religion? Superman instinctively knows right from wrong. But I'm here in Milwaukee now to tell you and your listeners that Superman's true faith is he is Jewish. And it's not just that his two creators were Jews. It is that I told you the story the Christians tell about Superman. To Jews, it's a little bit different story. It's parents trying to save their only son by floating him. There was no river around, so floating him out into outer space, where he ended up in the American heartland not far from here, adopted by two of the most consummate Gentiles you will ever meet named John and Martha Kent, who raise him as their own and realize they've got an extraordinary child. And this is obviously the story of...
This is the Moses story.
The Moses, the Exodus story. The destruction of the planet Krypton is Genesis. There are lots of other ways that Jerry and Joe, I think, showed that they had a Jewish character in mind, including the next time Jerry invented a comic book character, it was a character called Funny Man, who had the one thing that Superman didn't have that might make us believe he was Jewish, which was a sense of humor. He looked like Danny Kaye. He went nowhere. And unfortunately, when Jerry finally got around with his funny man character to creating an explicitly Jewish character, when he had the confidence to do that, nobody paid attention. But there is one final and I think fun piece of evidence on Superman's true ethnicity, and there is a golden rule that any time a name ends in the word M-A-N, it's one of two things. It is either a superhero or a Jew, or in this case, it's both. So the next time your listeners see the word S-U-P-E-R-M-A-N, they should know it's not pronounced Superman, it's Superman.
Well, was faith ever dealt with explicitly in Superman or Superman, as the case may be, either in the comic book strips or any of the other permutations that he had?
No. In fact, for his disguise, Jerry gave the character the most consummate white bread wasp name out there, Clark Kent. And it wasn't until the 1990s that things like the Holocaust story were, in a retrospective, invented to have Superman involved with his Jewish ethnicity. So it's really only when we read between the lines. The lines were there, very distinctly drawn, that in those days you didn't write in a particular ethnicity because you'd be afraid of alienating everybody else. And Jews were a small enough minority that that wasn't going to drive sales. So even though over the years a disproportionate numbers of the writers and artists and editors and even some of the actors who were involved in the Superman franchise were Jewish, the character wasn't, or not apparently so.
Well, but at the same time, early on, Superman did take on people like white supremacists. There were plot lines where he was essentially taking on the Klan.
So if those are Jewish values or if those are Christian values, Superman exhibited them in spades. He was taking on the Ku Klux Klan on a radio series years before most of America was willing to stand up and take on the Klan. Superman was actually announcing over the airwaves the secret Ku Klux Klan passwords. He was taking on all kinds of wonderful causes. He actually started out in his earliest days in the 1930s as being a great New Deal liberal. He was out there chasing down slumlords and wife beaters, just like FDR was trying to do from the White House.
And at the same time, as the time went on, the people who controlled the purse strings of Superman became sort of less willing to let him take those causes on.
True. What he ended up doing over the years, I like to say that Superman evolved more than the fruit fly. When Reagan was in vogue in the 1980s, Superman cut his hair and trimmed back his liberal politics. In the years 2000 and teens that we're in right now, it was only about 6 months ago that Superman quit the Daily Planet and did what all good journalists seem to be doing these days. He became a blogger. In every era, Superman took on what seemed to be what America was looking for in the outer evidence of his character. But the thing that I think is really the key to his success is that he never changed his sense of Dudley Do-Right do-goodism, that he was the one character. We had dark heroes like Batman. We had fraught heroes like Spider-Man. Superman was the one hero, as clunky and as old-fashioned as it seems, who always knew right from wrong and did right.
But as time went on, it did not take long for Superman to go from being seen as this moral force to having people think of him as somehow corrupting the nation's youth.
Yes, it was not just anybody who thought of him corrupting the nation's youth. It was the comic book version of Joe McCarthy. It was a psychiatrist who was leading the PTA and the Christian temperance groups and everybody else to look for an explanation for juvenile delinquency. And they came up with an explanation about as simplistic as McCarthy's explanation of what was going on with the Red Scare. The explanation was that comic books were perverting the minds of America's youth. And how did they arrive at this explanation? They went in and talked to lots of juvenile delinquents and said, "Do you read comic books?" Well, if they'd asked the same question to anybody who was growing up in that era, the answer would have been yes. And if there was any comic book that didn't deserve to be caught up in this web, it was the good guy, secular messiah, Superman.
Well, and you also write that they could just as easily have asked these juvenile delinquents if they chewed bubble gum.
Absolutely. That would have been another good question for him.
There are some other interesting angles to this book that I think a lot of people probably don't remember or don't even realize about Superman. And one of them is that at one point in the 1960s, as perhaps his popularity was waning in some ways, they tried to create a Superman musical on Broadway.
They did, and that lasted for about as long as any musical is guaranteed to last because they've pumped the money in. And it was caught up in a number of things. One is that Batman's TV show was taking off, and they called it Capelash in terms of what happened to Superman. The other is that they tried a little too much to bring in song and dance to a very serious group of kids who thought Superman was theirs. And these kids couldn't afford to go to theater, and parents and kids, it just didn't quite work. But that is one of the very few media in the long 75-year history where he hasn't stayed at the top of the heap for a long time.
Well, and there's a generation of younger people today that's used to seeing Superman on both a large screen and in different incarnations on the small screen. But how important would you say the movie of Superman in the late 1970s was to continuing to basically allowing Superman to endure into the 21st century?
So the three most important things behind Superman's endurance were the original character that Jerry and Joe gave us in the comic books, the 1950s and 60s, early 60s TV series starring George Reeve, and the only thing that brought in even more fans, and you ask people of a certain generation when they fell in love with Superman, it was when Christopher Reeve played him in four movies, two of which were good, two of which were terrible, all of which imprinted him as a big screen success. He was the first superhero to make it that big at the movieplex.
Why was Superman important to you when you were growing up?
He was really important to me when I was growing up because he was just the most clear cut. I always loved the notion of sort of clarity. I was a someday budding journalist, and I think that the idea of somebody who made things as clear as they were in terms of, again, what was right and wrong, it was sort of like watching a Sherlock Holmes adventure. You may know that Sherlock Holmes in the end was going to win, but it didn't make it any less interesting how he got there. And there was something wonderfully streamlined about it, and the chance as an adult to go back and revisit this. I put in selling it to a publisher, you put all sorts of gloss on it that I wanted to understand America and its hero worship and why was Superman the longest lasting hero. The truth is I wanted to be 10 years old again, and this book let me do that.
Which version of Superman was most important to you?
George Reeves. He was so good that I never asked when I was a kid. It was mainly street thugs that he was fighting against, and they would shoot a gun at him. Six bullets would bounce off, and I never asked why when they got frustrated and threw the gun at him, Superman would die. I wanted to believe, America wanted to believe, and it worked.
As you have toured, do you find Superman is still important to people? And is he as important to younger people as he is to the people who remember him from the George Reeves days?
So I've written, this was my sixth book, and done a lot of book tours, and I've never found a topic where kids and their parents and grandparents could all come, all feel a special ownership of the character that I was writing about, and all in some way adore him. As much as the kids do, the grandparents, when you talk to them about George Reeves or about when I say that I met Noel Neal, the TV Lois Lane, people love those stories because that is revisiting their own youth.
It must have been something to have met Noel Neal.
It was really wonderful. And so I was at a talk. The audience was half full, a big auditorium. Noel Neal walks in, and by the magic of high technology, within about 5 minutes, it was standing room only. And I realized at the end of it, they had no interest at all in what I was saying about the book. They all wanted to pose for a picture with Lois Lane.
Well, Larry Tai, it is a fascinating book, and I thank you so much for sharing the backstory with us.
Thanks for having me in to do it.
Larry Tai is author of Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, published by Random House. Tai, who lives in Boston, also runs a program there for medical journalists. Among his previous books is a biography of Satchel Paige. We'll take one more break, and then the story of Superman's creator takes flight in the Milwaukee Rep's next production. We'll learn about the history of invulnerability when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we learned a great deal about the backstory of the Man of Steel, including his creator, Jerry Siegel. a new play being performed at Milwaukee Repertory Theater, introduces us to the real-life heroes and villains who brought Superman to life. The History of Invulnerability takes us inside the mind and thoughts of Jerry Siegel as he reflects on his life. Milwaukee Rep Artistic Director Mark Clements explains to Lake Effect Stephanie Lutche that the play details how Siegel and his partner, illustrator Joe Shuster, created a character that would capture the hearts and minds of millions only to lose creative control of him.
What the show is about is Jerry Siegel, the creator of Superman. He and Joe Shuster created the original character. Joe Shuster was the illustrator and Jerry Siegel was the writer. And really what drew me to the play was this fact that these two guys in their early 20s in a house that they were living in still with their parents in Cleveland wrote this, you know, sort of created this character and then a few years later sold the rights to DC Comics for $130 and then kind of lived in a perpetual state of, you know, mental torture for the end, because not only they weren't able to nurture the character in the way that they wanted, although they were on salary and worked for DC Comics for a while, but they weren't able to have editorial control of where the character went and what it did. And, and they also sold it for $130. So it was like tantamount, really, with that property becoming a $1 billion franchise, worldwide franchise, to that it was tantamount to losing the Powerball lottery ticket, you know, and when you had the full set of numbers. So I think that was one of the things that caught my imagination. And this play is a memory play, and it actually is Jerry Siegel's, what is happening in Jerry Siegel's brain an hour and 36 minutes before he dies. So it's like running the reel of his life back and trying to come to terms before he leaves this earth with some sense of closure for himself.
Well, and what I think is really interesting, too, in the staging is Superman is there. There's interaction there.
You see Superman in a way that you don't normally see him. He does things and says things because in the play, I don't want to give too much away, the surprises, but he acts as Jerry's alter ego. I mean, Jerry created Superman. Jerry and Joe created Superman. They were two young Jewish boys who were of a period of time when Jews were often having to sort of assimilate and dumb down their culture and dumb down their origins because they felt that was going to get in the way of getting on in life. And there was a sort of innate feeling of being a second-class citizen. So a lot of these superhero creators, Batman, Spider-Man, they were Jewish boys who actually were creating alter egos to empower themselves in life. And you've got this character when Jerry's running, as I say, running the reel of his life at the end, using Superman as the owner of the truth, the real truth, rather than the selective memory and the truth that we as individuals live in life and make our own, rather than it being the truth. So I think Superman acts as a sort of confessor figure and a conduit to helping Jerry own his truth so that he can eventually have a sense of closure.
And that is, in fact, what Superman is all about, is truth and justice.
Exactly, yeah.
In the play, do you think we get a sense of perhaps what was lost or what could have been with Superman had Siegel and Shuster been able to have that full editorial control over their character?
That's a really good question. I don't know. You know, one of the things in the play is, you know, you can take a very simplistic argument, and this happens all the time. It happens in literature with publishing companies. It happens in the music industry. I just watched that movie Artifact, you know, about Jared Leto and the ownership of, you know, with EMI, whether it be Superman and, you know, with Jerry Siegel and DC Comics. It takes a lot to make something. It's not one component part. The genius of the original idea is not enough. At some point, a business needs to step in to make it what it is, to distribute it, to publicize it, to package it, if you like, into something that everybody can have access to or at least be aware of to be able to buy it. I think it's very hard at that point for the original writers to go, hey, my idea was hijacked, it was taken away. I do think unquestionably that Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster were treated badly. I mean, if they weren't The film industry wouldn't have cared however much pressure was put on. And in fact, at the time of the Christopher Reeve movie being released in 78, they did actually receive for life a $25,000 a year plus health insurance payments for the rest of their lives. But I guess in relation to it being a billion-dollar franchise, $25,000 a year and health insurance is not a life changer. It offers a little bit of security. It doesn't change your life, which is why the Siegel family, up until last year, was with the Man of Steel being produced, were actually still trying to take DC Comics and the owners of Superman to court to see if, like, for unfair loss of earnings and lack of recognition. It's still going on, my understanding today, with whoever family members are left. So it's a very complex situation, and I don't know, whether who knows? I don't think we can possibly know. I don't think it's black and white, and I think the play flags that up enough. I mean, really, the play is set in Jerry's mind, so it's Jerry's story and how he was treated. And, no question they were treated badly. And I think they were partly treated badly because they were working-class Jewish boys from Cleveland, and nobody cared what they thought. And they fleeced them, both of them. And so I think that definitely came into play. So there's no question they were treated badly. If they'd had full editorial control, would they have had the experience and the know-how how to do that? And they would have still needed people like Harry Donenfeld, as, unpleasant as we certainly portrayed as an unpleasant character in our play, although there is – we found documentary evidence that Harry Donenfeld smuggled Jews out of Germany and funded that operation. So, it's a lot of gray areas. And that's why people to this day are still writing huge reams, books on, this year alone, I think there were two major books came out about Superman, and people are still finding different angles on that character to write about, which is fascinating in itself.
Well, you mentioned the gray areas. There are a lot of gray areas in Jerry Siegel's life. That's one of the other themes as he is remembering his life and perhaps some of the mistakes he's made. How does Superman take him to task on those?
Superman takes him to task in quite an upfront way. I mean, I think what you're referring to is that his first marriage to Bella yielded a son, Michael, who once Jerry left the marital home, he never saw Michael again. They never had anything to do with one another. And there are different stories depending on what you read. The story that we portray in the play definitely has Superman bringing it to Jerry's attention that he abandoned Jerry's mother for Joanne, formerly Jolan, who was the inspiration for Lois Lane in the original cartoon. So they met he met the original Jolan, who was they just advertised for a model, and she walked through the door, and they drew her in their house in 1934, and then they didn't actually reunite and get married, meet again after the divorce. And I think the divorce was partly due to his relationship with her. But that wasn't until 1948. So it was a long time passed, And there are so many different reports of how that went down. I think, again, in the play, we're having a play, the play. And David Barkatz's play is taking a dramatic angle on certain things, a certain stance. But it's kind of an interesting stance because Superman acts as the leveler, getting Jerry to face his own truth. And he said, look, this is your truth. That's not necessarily the truth. At one point, he lets off this stream of abuse against Harry Donenfeld. It says Harry Donenfeld, was a Jew who sold himself out. He was a pornographer. He was this, that. He was he fraternized with Lucky Luciano, the mobster, and all of those things are true in part, but it isn't the whole story. And Superman says, that's not the letter he wrote to you. He didn't write that letter to you. He said, yes, he did. And he goes, no, he didn't, and shows him the letter. And he goes, well, it felt like he did. So it's very much Jerry's story, how he sees the truth. But then Superman trying to peel away those layers of the onion to get to the core and say, listen, if you want to leave this world with some sense of closure and peace, you need to face the truth. And there are things that you are beating yourself up about that actually you need to be proud of. And there are things here that actually you need to own. And part of the closure is actually saying I made a mistake and I was responsible for that. And sometimes Jerry's hard on himself and Superman gives him the other view. But we just don't know for sure.
I find it really interesting as we're talking about Superman, his origins, especially coming out of Jerry Siegel, who is this complicated guy like anyone. He had a life that had shades of gray. Yet one of the criticisms that has long been leveled against the Superman character is that he lives in a world of black and white, that there isn't really room for these grays. Would you still agree with that?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like, you know, as I say, I'm not an expert and there are people far more versed in the background of it. It seems to me, you know, that originally they were writing for children's comics. You know, their audience was children and it became apparent that what they were writing had a far more reaching effect. And actually, when those children became adults, that character was still important to them. So the things and the themes that were being explored in their comic books were not only important to kids, but they were also important to adults. You know, one of the reasons for introducing kryptonite that could threaten Superman, an Achilles heel, if you're thinking of it in biblical terms, you know, was an important thing to Jerry because he realized that if there wasn't some threat to him, then there's no drama and there has to be some point where he's fallible. And I think in some of the movies, you do definitely see Superman, who is in effect an alien from Krypton, being by his parents, Lara and Jor-El, being given a human body so he can fit in on Earth with superpowers. You know, you see that the part that they don't recognizes that once that he's on Earth, he's going to start assimilating himself to the environment around him. So suddenly things like emotion are going to come into play. You do get a situation when the story does, after quite some time, I think it's 40 years before Superman reveals himself to Lois, and we have this in the play actually, in a mine shaft where he reveals who he is for the first time. That's a big move forward. And the reason he does that is because he's feeling emotion because he wants Lois to feel that he cares. And if he saves her, how is he going to be able to do that just being a mortal? And he has to make that big decision. But I think there are areas there that I think the creators and the people who've taken the mantle on in this day and age, I think that's an important part where they do put something in where Superman has dichotomies, whether they be personal or otherwise. You know, if I save this person, am I going to smash this building up or am I going to destroy this to save this? You know, he's almost looking, if you want to, in modern terminology, he's looking at the potential for collateral damage. So there is an emotion. It's not cut and dry. So I wouldn't say, in my experience of where the character has been developed, probably from the late 40s on, I feel like that's been something that people have said in order to relate to people, I think this has to be less black and white. So I wouldn't say it's completely black and white. No, I definitely see Superman having to weigh up values of things of what move he does. So that for me is an area of gray.
Does this play redeem in any way Jerry Siegel? And as you mentioned before, how he got fleeced and maybe some of his regrets over what happened?
It's really interesting because this is a relatively new play. It's only had two small productions. This will be the first major one it's had done. So it's really like dealing with a new play. And the end of the play is quite a shock. That's all I'm saying. I feel like most of the plays that I work on and the stories that I want to tell at this phase of my career and life, telling redemptive stories, not necessarily cut and dry feel-good endings, but endings that offer some sense of hope and light and future are kind of important to me. Because I think we're living in extremely challenging, dark times a lot of the time. We're constantly jolted back as a big reminder with that. You know, it seems that we cannot go a few days where we kind of we get back into our groove and something happens in the world that jolts us. The stories can be not cut and dry, black and white. They can be informative and they can be entertaining, but I think they can be redemptive in a number of ways. But I think definitely having some sense of redemption and hope in my storytelling and the work that I'm doing is definitely of key importance to me right now.
Well, Mark Clemens, thank you so much for coming in.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Milwaukee Reps production of The History of Invulnerability runs April 8th through May 4th at the Quadracci Powerhouse with opening night set for April 12th. Mark Clemens is artistic director at the Rep and directs this production, and he spoke with Stephanie Lachey. That's all for the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. On the Wednesday show, a conversation with former Milwaukee Journal reporter Kevin Merida, now managing editor for The Washington Post. And if spring cleaning is in your plan, we'll chat with the author of Deadspin's Ask a Clean Person column. I'm Mitch Teich. Before we go today, those of you waiting for the interview about the floating arena concept in downtown Milwaukee, we mentioned at the top of the show, we'll want to check your calendars and note that it is, in fact, April 1st.
Superman never made any money for saving the world from Solomon Grundy. Sometimes I despair the world will never see another man like him.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.